about censored news.
Well, I'm reading. He's telling lies, 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 lies. Up the truth with something funny, I start to see he's telling lies, 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 lies. Oh, I never had this problem with nobody in the government. I guess I always figured they never mean what they meant. And God help us all not to be so stone surprised if we wake up in the stars with the skies in our eyes. If we keep telling lies, 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 lies,
lies, lies. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystem, environmental, social, technological. We'll shortly be talking with Andy Lee Roth. He's the co-author of Project Censored, State of the Free Press 2022. This book is about important information that doesn't receive full press coverage because of pressures applied on the news media.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland, a financial advisor with Edward Jones. In Chico, no matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, college savings accounts, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-8913 or on the corner of 3rd Avenue and the Esplanade. Neil Yellen, Edward Jones, member SIPC. And Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of you all, KZFR supporters, and by J&J Automotive in Chico. With over 19 years of experience in auto repair and scheduled maintenance, specialize in Subaru, Volvo, and Volvo, J&J provides everything from manufacturer-suggested vehicle maintenance to all types of repairs, including transmission and engine repair, brake and suspension, tune-ups, lubes, filters, lights, and more. To book an appointment or for more information, visit jandjautomotivechico.com and at 530-891-3328. The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. We'll be back in a moment to talk with Andy Roth about
Project Censored.
Project Censored.
We'll be right back.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight, our topic is censorship, but not in the way in which we usually think of it, with authorities redlining, suppressing, or burning books. Project Censored, established a long time ago, about 45 years, publishes an annual book describing important stories that do not receive full publicity for a variety of reasons that lead to de facto censorship. We just don't hear about them. We're not talking about fake news here, but legitimate news, including environmental stories that are essentially suppressed by a variety of powers.
Our guest on the phone with us is Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored and co-editor of Project Censored's State of the Free Press 2022. He coordinates the project's Campus Affiliates Program, a news media research network of several hundred students and faculty at 24 colleges and universities across North America. He earned a PhD in sociology at UCLA and a BA in sociology and anthropology at Haverford College. Roth serves on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation, the sponsoring organization of Project Censored. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks so much, Susan. It's a pleasure to join you and Stephen on Ecotopia.
Andy, please. Thank you. Yeah, we're delighted to have you. It's a wonderful book. We've been following Project Censored for a long time. There are a number of followers of the Project Censored publication here in Chico. But perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the origins. How long has it been there? How did it come about? What was the need that led the organizers, the founders, to see the problem?
Well, Project Censored originated not so far from Chico, on the campus of Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, where Carl Jensen was a professor teaching sociology and communications. Carl had a background in journalism and advertising, and he taught courses at Sonoma State on media and politics. And kind of founding story for the project is that on the night that Richard Nixon was reelected as president of the United States, Carl and some of his students noticed there hadn't been a single mention of the Watergate scandal on any of the major TV networks covering Nixon's reelection. Mm-hmm. And they were struck by that omission. And it led Carl and his students to wonder what other kinds of stories aren't being well covered or adequately covered by the kind of mainstream press. And they began digging stories. And here we are. That was way back, you know, as you say, 40 some years ago. Here we are in 2022. And students and faculty across the country, part of this Campus Affiliates program that the project coordinates, are doing the same thing. I like to say that we were doing, that, you know, Carl and his students were doing critical media literacy with regard to news and propaganda before we had the term critical media literacy.
Mm-hmm. We wanted to ask about how you just define censorship. What are some of the forces at work that censor important news?
Well, one of the things about Project Censored is, you know, we began, the project began in the mid-70s, but we need, and we have, I think, a what you could think of as a 21st century definition of censorship. This is based on, you know, Carl Jensen's kind of original definition of censorship as, and I'll quote here directly, the suppression of information, whether purposeful or not, by any method, including bias, omission, underreporting, or self-censorship, that prevents the public from fully knowing what's happening in its society. And so, building on that, Mickey Huff, the director of the project, and I have been talking some about what are some of the differences between the sort of media ecosystem when the project was first founded, mm-hmm. and how it looks today. And so we talk about a 21st century definition of media censorship that that includes not only, as you note in the introduction to the program tonight, not only what we tend to think of as kind of traditional gatekeeping modes of censorship, where an editor at a news organization says, I'm not going to run that story, and what we know in legal terms is prior restraint, where the government or some other powerful mm-hmm. entity prohibits the production of some story. But also, in 21st century context, things like algorithmic censorship and other mm-hmm. ways that advertising interests and corporate ownership shape and indeed filter what is available to us in a ready, accessible way as, quote, the news.
So you talk about the forces of advertising and... So what else is at work? Who's responsible for the how this happens, for us not getting some important news?
Well, increasingly, and this is a product of the internet, increasingly most Americans, according to the polling done by Pew Research, most Americans are now accessing their news through social media platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Those social media platforms are controlled by what I think of as the social media giants. So, Alphabet, which owns a whole host of entities, Meta, which we've known formerly as Facebook, mm-hmm. and Instagram and WhatsApp. And I think the most important thing I would say to know about these social media giants, these big tech platforms, is that they don't see themselves as engaged in journalism, and they don't hold themselves to any of the ethical standards that good journalism does.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've argued that we have, in effect, a new form of gatekeeping. The old model of gatekeeping was that there would be, say, an editor at the local paper, and he or she wouldn't run a story on a given topic because perhaps they had political biases that shaped their news understanding. And there was concern about gatekeeping of news in that kind of personal way. What we have today is, in effect, artificial intelligence, AI, algorithmically driven gatekeeping. And whereas in the past, interested parties, social scientists and others could go observe how editors and journalists made choices about what to cover and what not to cover, because these gatekeeping algorithms, mm-hmm. these new digital gatekeeping algorithms are considered proprietary by the likes of Google, Facebook and others, we have no third-party access to them. So we don't know how they operate. All we can do is observe indirectly the effects of their operation.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do so, as colleagues of mine, including Abram Anderson, who's a librarian at McAllister College outside of Minneapolis-St. Paul, as Abram Anderson and I have done, we've looked at news coverage on the Google News aggregator. We've looked at news coverage of LGBTQ issues and found significant bias in how the Google News aggregator, what it counts as news relative to LGBTQ issues. So we don't know it. We don't know whether that bias is in effect baked into the algorithm or whether savvy users are exploiting what's known about the algorithm to promote homophobic and transphobic content, for example. But we know that that's happening, and we know that it is worse at Google News than it is at, say, other news aggregators like the DuckDuckGo news aggregator. That's not a pitch for DuckDuckGo, but more an indication of the way we can study these sorts of bias and effect indirectly.
So there are a couple sources of the information that's coming through. One, I know from my experience with Google News and others, they claim that they simply are reprinting whatever is popular at the moment. So there you would get kind of a tyranny of the majority. If everybody's interested in the State of the Union address, then boom, it will pop up. But we also know that they are now under pressure from the government, exercising a gatekeeper function, particularly with hate stories. So they claim they're making an effort to weed those out. But on the third hand, he said, the same gatekeeping mechanism could influence how they treat LGBTQ stories as well. Could you help us get a sense of what these algorithms are up to, and of course, who wrote them in the first place?
Right. Well, we know a little bit about that last point. Most of the kind of tech community is not as diverse as the society as a whole. And that lack of diversity may be a factor in the algorithms. But again, as I say, they're proprietary. They're in effect a kind of black box, and we don't know what's baked in as opposed to what's available for, external third-party omission. I think the biggest difference, though, would be like that these companies don't have a commitment to fundamental journalistic ethics. Mm-hmm. That's not their interest. They don't see themselves, as I say, as journalism organizations, which is probably correct and fair, but they therefore have no commitment to the kind of ethics that the Society of Professional Journalists advocates. Simple but profound guidelines like seek the truth and report it, minimize harm, act independently, be accountable and transparent. Google, Facebook, Twitter, etc., although they pay lip service to some of those ideas, the bottom line is that they're corporations, and they are driven by what drives all corporations, which is generating profits for shareholders. And so whatever it is that will keep, eyeballs on the screen, will keep us scrolling through for the next item, is what they're going to promote. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's real questions about what that does in terms of kind of the credibility, the trustworthiness, and the transparency of the kind of journalism that we know is a foundation for democracy, right? You can't have democracy without a well-informed and engaged bunch of citizens or community members. And so I think there are profound challenges to journalism posed by these big tech platforms that operate by a very different logic than the best of our journalism does.
We're going to come back and talk a little more about those media giants, but we also want to ask about what's happened to journalism in the years that Project Censored has been going on. We know that newspapers are dropping like flies. We have some major ones, but some of those, we are subscribers to the New York Times, and we can certainly detect their liberal bias. They're not giving us straight up neutral news. It's not an algorithm. It's what their editorial board thinks. And there have been accusations of media bias in the Times, of stories that don't get covered because there's pressure on newspapers. We could talk about the Washington Post as well, and Jeff Bezos as the owner. So give us the skinny on what's going on with print journalism.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some fundamental changes in news and sort of news as an ecosystem, journalism as a profession since the founding of the project. And I propose this will be a galloping history in reverse, I'll put it that way. We'll start with COVID-19. The Poynter Institute at the end of last year came out with a study that there have been more than 100 newsroom closures since March 2020, when we first became aware of the COVID-19 virus and what we came to know subsequently as the pandemic. So 100...
Yeah, that's a lot, I think.
100 closures of local newsrooms. This this accelerated and amplified a process that was already going that we talk about as news deserts or news desertification. The idea that there are local communities where there is no local news reporting whatsoever. And there are deep problems with that, obvious ones at the surface. How can you, how do you learn about what's happening locally when there's no local news reporting? It creates a vacuum where other opportunistic entities can come in and play on and exploit the need for local news and exploit, you know, previous trust in local news reporting outlets to produce something that looks like news, but maybe isn't what we'd want to really think of as news. And Project Censored is actually tracked in our previous, in last year's top 25 list, how a number of conservative political organizations have swooped into these so-called news deserts to take advantage of the absence of local reporting to promote what we could, I think, fairly easily say would be political interests rather than journalistic ones. Mm-hmm. So we can start with the closure of newsrooms across the country, local newsrooms across the country as a result of the pandemic. And then we could leap backwards a year or two to the summer of 2020 and talk about how journalists are increasingly under attack in the United States. There are physical threats to journalists of a sort that are fairly unprecedented in the history of U.S. journalism. Mm-hmm. With the rise of Black Lives Matter events and protests, journalists increasingly faced attacks from law enforcement. The U.S. Press Freedom Tracker has documented more arrests of journalists, more detainments of journalists, more journalists being injured or having their equipment damaged than at any prior time in the period they've been tracking those sorts of statistics. And then if we go back even further to the 1990s, of course, we've had a massive consolidation of ownership of, yes, of journalistic outlets. The Telecommunications Act of 1996, which deregulated media ownership in radical, revolutionary ways, has basically brought to reality what Ben Bagdikian, the author of the book The Media Monopoly, had seen coming as early as the mid-'80s, which was that, you know, something like 90-some percent of our the media that we see, that's everything from news to movies and magazines and music and the whole all of wax that we call media is now produced by, depending on how you count the conglomerates, five or six mega corporations. And there are real concerns that Carl Jensen was well aware of when he founded Project Censored. There are real concerns about how a lack of diversity in ownership relates to a lack of diversity in content when it comes to media. We've seen major changes that are, I think, you know, cold water in the face for anyone who thinks it's a simple and easy thing to say, oh, we have a free press in the United States because of the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I wonder if we could take a hypothetical editor running a newspaper, and I'm not talking about Chico or any place else here, a hypothetical editor, but he's owned by a chain, the paper's owned by a chain, and he or she, what kinds of pressures might be exerted on that editor? And would the editor really even know that they're being exerted necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one. It's not, I mean, I wouldn't say that anyone who works in the corporate news media is a bad person. I think there are, you know, there's fantastic reporting coming out of places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, and local newspapers as well. But that doesn't mean the people engaged in that reporting, from the beat reporters all the way up to the editors and the owners, aren't under severe economic pressure to attract audiences. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, one of the things when I taught classes on the sociology of news at Sonoma State for a while, at Pomona College, at Citrus College in Southern California, I would always remind my students that when they were engaging in media, it was important to remember that they were the product. They were the thing, right? The audience is the product that's being bought and sold. We tend to think, if we're watching, say, the TV news or flipping through the newspaper, and there are the ads on the columns, the increasingly thin columns mm-hmm. of the actual newsprint, that the, you know, it's the ads for cars and ask your doctor about medications, that those are the products. But from a political economy perspective, when we think about media and media consumption, the audience is the product that's being bought and sold.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
that hypothetical owner of the local paper has to make a profit, or they'll be driven out of business.
Yes.
And the way they make profits is they either have to sell subscriptions, which are increasingly difficult as we mm-hmm. as we become more and more screen driven in terms of our media use. They either have to sell subscriptions or they have to sell advertising, and both of those have been absolutely revolutionized by the internet and social media in ways that journalism as a field is just, I think, still reeling against the ropes, trying to figure out how to not be knocked out.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Andy Lee Roth, who is Associate Director of Project Censored and co-author of Project Censored, State of the Free Press 2022. And I just want to go back a little bit, because I'm a little bit confused about one thing. This always happens to me. with social media, with Facebook, Twitter, those kinds of things, I don't use Facebook anymore because it was a huge time suck. I use Instagram a little bit, but not very much. So I don't understand. I went to Facebook and Instagram to learn what was going on with people that I know and to keep caught up with those people. So where does the, how does the news part get in there? I know, I mean, a lot of times people post things that they want us to read, and I did too when I was on Facebook. So is the news dropped into those personal things? I guess I'm just a little confused about how social media
becomes a news source.
I think it's not on you that you're confused. It's a complex topic that isn't at all transparent if you just go online and use Facebook, right?
Uh-huh.
Some colleagues of mine at Project Censored and I are now working on a book about critical media literacy for young readers.
Oh.
And one of the things that we talk about over and over in that book, and I think it's not just a message for young people, it's a message for almost everyone in our society, is that, you know, these aren't neutral platforms, that they're organized to guide our behavior, right? They're not just, the algorithms aren't just trying to predict our behavior, they're gathering data about it so they can alter our behavior. So if we talk about the sharing of news stories online, I think there are two basic ways I think that news stories are circulating, say, on a platform like Facebook. One is, you know, the news outlet itself may have an account and be putting stuff out there. As critical as I am of Facebook, Project Censored uses Facebook, and it's a way we reach people to mm-hmm. share our message and to hopefully fulfill our mission. So news organizations themselves may be posting stuff on Facebook or other socials. Susan, as you suggest, of course, people are sharing what they think is important. And those networks, especially Facebook, is designed for exactly that to happen and to drive the a sense that this is a vibrant public forum. But the challenge is that, you know, so a general population has ineffectively been herded onto what are these giant monopolistic social media platforms that give lip service to the idea of providing a voice for everyone and democratizing mm-hmm. information, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But those platforms then hold the power to, you know, under the guise sometimes of content curation or community standards, to effectively censor what they deem as unacceptable speech.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that's not obvious if you just go on and use the platform.
Right.
It's
mm-hmm.
only if you sit back and think about, well, what my training is as a sociologist, so I think about power and social relationships all the time. Right. It's only if you kind of step back from being an active user to thinking about, well, what's going on when I engage the platform. Right? What's going on when I share a story or when I like a story that someone else has shared? How am I participating and with what consequences? Right? I think everything about social media, I think, is designed to make us feel like we are behind,
right.
Not engaging quickly enough.
Right, right.
That we ought to be engaging more quickly. And everything about critical media literacy is, in my opinion, about slowing down.
Right.
And saying, wait a minute, before I share this story with the sensational headline or the amazing fact that I've never heard before, maybe I need to slow down and double check this, right? To engage my critical thinking skills and say, like, okay, what's the evidence for the claims made? There are 100 links in this story, but where do they go to? Right? Do the links actually take me to an article that substantiates the claim that was made there? The story may look like it's quoting all kinds of diverse sources, but are they really diverse? Right? If it's only Congress people who are being quoted in a story about a welfare policy that affects the poor, we have the illusion perhaps of diversity in perspectives because we've got Republicans and Democrats and maybe various flavors of each. But if we aren't, you know, if the article doesn't actually give voice to any poor people, organizations that represent people who are poor, maybe that diversity is more illusory than real. But these are the kinds of things, if you're moving fast, social media encourages us to do all the time, either explicitly or implicitly, there's no time to engage the critical thinking skills that I think we all have. And then I think that's how, you know, that's one way that fake news or disinformation and misinformation circulate. And then, of course, the nasty thing is, the Facebooks and the Twitters and the YouTubes of the world say, oh, well, we can't be party to the promotion, the distribution of fake news or misinformation, be it about Russia or COVID-19 or whatever. So we then have to take on a kind of Leviathan role and either regulate it ourselves or call in some third party to help us regulate it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, those third parties, again, they should be subject to the same kind of critical thinking scrutiny that we operate, that we use with regard to the news itself.
We're talking with Andy Ross. He's the co-editor of Project Censored, State of the Free Press 2022. We wanted Andy to get one or two, maybe two examples of censored news in 2022. And there were several, I think about 10 environmental stories in your book. I wonder if you could tell us about one or two of those. One of that caught my eye was European demand for biomass energy propels destruction of U.S. forests. What was the story and who was keeping us from reading about that information?
Well, before I dive into that particular story, let me say about environmental stories in general, that these are the kinds of stories that are often underreported or inadequately reported by the corporate media because they involve systemic social problems. Right? A lot of what passes as news in the corporate media is what went wrong today, which means there's more of a blind spot or a gap in the corporate news media's awareness of the things that go wrong every day. Right. So here's a case in point. This story was originally reported by Truthout, a fantastic independent news organization. The basic idea is that, you know, biomass energy sounds like a fantastic green renewable source of energy. Biomass energy uses plants, wood, waste materials as sources for heating or power. And the EU increasingly is reliant on biomass for its renewable energy. The popular belief is that the EU, the European Union, is really all about solar and wind power as renewable energy sources, but biomass is a major one. Despite the fact that scientists from around the world have warned about the unintended consequences of using biomass, which, in the words of one of these reports, speeds up carbon emissions, pollution, and forest destruction. And so I think of this story about the European demand for biomass of energy propelling the destruction of U.S. forests as almost like a second round of colonialism that's deeply impacting the southern United States, the coastal plains of North and South Carolina, southern Georgia and Alabama, northern Florida. These are where some of the most devastating and costly flooding events in the world have been happening. Mm-hmm. And those coincide with the deforestation of these places to meet the what the Truthout report describes as a voracious European demand for wood pellets to be burned as biomass.
Okay. Fascinating. We want to shift a little bit to education, critical education at your project with the colleges. I want to begin, though, by telling you a little story, actually bragging a little bit. I taught radio drama course to middle school kids over Zoom in the fall, and one of our projects was for them to do radio commercials in the old 1940s style. And one of my groups came up with an advertisement for the Apple iPhone 2000, and they said, this phone has 10,000 lenses, so you with those lenses you can see anything all the time. And their little commercial ended with a disclaimer, said, the Apple Corporation takes no responsibility for anything negative that may happen as a result of this. So I thought these guys were really quite sharp. They know what's going on. But I was thinking later, I don't have any idea what to do with them next. How could these kids who are 13-year-old, what could I do in the classroom? What could teachers do to help move them along so that they might be a force in fighting propaganda, advertising, news suppression, and so forth? Big question, but I'd really like to hear your answer.
First of all, I think that's a great assignment, and I think your students are incredibly savvy, and some of them will probably be writing, you know, skewering satire for South Park or the like when they're a little bit older.
Right.
They're not responsible for any of the effects of our technology. That's a serious commentary. And it's true of all kinds of things, not just, you know, an all-seeing smartphone, but many of the apps that we use, dating apps, not as much in the United States, but in other, although there are sectors of the United States where this would be true, dating apps that don't provide protections for their users when they may be members of groups that are marginalized, right, by gender identity or sexual orientation. Article 19, which is a group that champions freedom of expression, takes their name from the specific article of the UN Declaration of Human Rights that declares freedom of expression and the ability to transmit ideas is a fundamental human right. Article 19 has done important campaigns in places around the world, such as Egypt and other nations, where people are using dating apps without being aware of how the dating apps make them vulnerable to state surveillance and the repercussions of it. But I think in terms of going back to kind of, well, next steps, one of my favorite things to do, and it's very simple, you don't need big tech to do it, is to take a news story on a topic of interest to you or the person who's doing it, and just look at who's quoted. And make a list, you know, in the margin if it's a print story, or, you know, on a separate sheet of paper if you're watching off of a screen. Make a list of everyone who's quoted, directly quoted, right? And then look at what kinds of people are getting quoted in that story. And you can look in all kinds of ways as what counts as what kind, right? It could be gender. It could be what is their professional status. I started doing those kinds of studies years ago. One of the earliest I did was a study about a movement in a community within Los Angeles for parkland. There, the community had families with children who are interested in playing soccer and other outdoor activities, and they didn't have enough parkland for those activities to take place. So they began advocating for parkland and were ultimately successful in getting an old railroad yard, an old defunct railroad yard called Taylor Yard, converted into a California state park. At the time, it was one of the first new urban state parks in the state in something like 75 years. Mostly lower income, working class community, very diverse, not the sort of communities that you would have said would have had right off the bat political clout to get their desires met by the powers that be. But when I looked at it, when I looked at the news coverage of the movement for a park in Taylor Yard, what you saw was that ordinary people were getting quoted with great regularity. They had formed a coalition for a state park at Taylor Yard, and that status was sufficient official status to get people who were otherwise identified as mothers and fathers, right, quoted in the LA Times and other relevant newspapers in a way that normally is reserved for people who are government or corporate officials. Right? And you know, the mayor of LA was still quoted on a regular basis, but right alongside the mayor, framing the arguments for why there ought to be a public space at this old rail yard were people who were just like, they weren't official in any way. They were the mothers and fathers of kids who wanted to play soccer on Saturday morning. And that kind of hit home for me. The rarity of that, combined with the fact that in that case, that people's movement was successful, got me sensitized to thinking about and always trying to analyze for any topic I'm interested in, who's quoted, who's treated as newsworthy, and how the selection of newsworthy sources shapes the framing of our understanding of that event or issue.
So one of the things I've been hearing from you kind of throughout this whole discussion is the impact of people who have a lot of power on what gets reported and doesn't get reported. Was there a time when reporting work was more democratic? Was there a time when regular people's voices were more a part of our news sources?
That's a great question. Thank you, Susan. I think the answer to the second is no. This is a case where I think there's room for a positive response and perhaps even some optimism. We've been talking about kind of patterns in corporate news coverage, but the thing to say now in Project Censored and our annual top 25 story lists are robust evidence of this is there's more really good independent news reporting in the United States than I think there ever has been in the history of U.S. journalism. The challenge is that it's competing against these giants that have huge platforms and enormous budgets to make their version of the news the predominant one. Right? So the corporate version of the news is based on narrow definitions of who and what count as newsworthy.
Right.
Independent news media, by and large, have much more inclusive definitions of who and what count as newsworthy. And so the next level to, you know, the question, to my answer to Stephen's question a moment ago is, you know, look at who's quoted and compare and contrast independent news coverage on the topic with corporate news coverage on the topic. And I predict that what you'll find in almost every case is a wider range of people being treated as newsworthy by independent journalists compared to their corporate counterparts.
So
I think there is space in journalism today that is, in effect, more inclusive and more democratic in the small d important sense of that term, of, by, and for people. It's just that news is, it gets buried in the kind of wash of you know, what we at Project Censored call junk food news and news abuse that is the, you know, the bulk of what is put out by corporate news outlets, especially if we're talking about the, you know, kind of television driven news. So the trick is to find it, and that's where
that's Carl the question
Jensen,
I had.
Carl Jensen had this great phrase that I always think of. He talked about news inflation, the idea we have more and more of it, but it's worth less and less. And I think of what the project is trying to do as to make good on Carl's legacy by countering news inflation by saying, look, the stories that we put forward in our top 25 story lists every year may not be ones you've heard about, but if you take the time to dig in and read them and engage with them, you know, kind of our guarantee is that we've vetted these stories multiple times. Every story before it makes the top 25 list goes through 5 independent rounds of vetting that involve collectively several hundred people. And so we're sure that when a story makes our top 25 list, that it's socially significant, that it is the story itself is a high quality journalistic effort, that it's transparently sourced and factually based, and that it's basically ultimately in the face of news inflation worth the reader's time to dig into that story.
And many of those stories are found by people in your curriculum of Campus Affiliates Project. Could you tell us a little about that? Who are the people finding those stories and submitting them to you?
This is part of the project that I'm most proud and most energized and made optimistic by. The majority of the stories that we track every year, and each year we track somewhere between 200 and 300 independent news stories. So the top 25 are really the cream of the cream, the ones that have passed through all those 5 stages of vetting successfully and then risen to the top of our judges' estimation when our international panel of judges vote to determine the top 25 list every spring. It's students. It's students at colleges and universities across the campus. Across the campus, across the United States, and some years also around the world, who are initially identifying and vetting these stories. I should add, without being too student-centric, that we also welcome and often receive fantastic story tips from interested community members. And there is a spot on the Project Censored website where we have information about our criteria for censored stories, quote, censored stories, and how to submit a nomination. And that's at projectcensored.org. But the Campus Affiliates Program now has been going for almost a little more than 10 years now, and it's a network of about 24 college and university campuses. And it engages, this year I can tell you as a matter of fact, 209 students from 10 different university and college campuses vetted the stories and contributed to the vetting of the stories that make up this year's top 25 mm-hmm. story list. That number varies from year to year depending on the faculty involved and their teaching schedules, which you can appreciate as educators yourselves. You don't always have a course that allows you to address every possible thing you'd want to address, and so you you know, the curriculum sometimes leads to some of our professors cycling out for a semester or two until they have a course that they feel is best suited for the kind of work that this vetting entails with their students.
Mm-hmm. We were hoping to maybe talk a little bit about Ukraine with you. We don't know if you want to go into that subject at all, but I was thinking about the campus project. If I'm a student, how do I find news that is actually being suppressed? For example, with Ukraine, I'm suspecting that there's a lot of suppression of news. We're getting good news about the effects of sanctions on Russia. There's kind of a hopeful tone that the Russian people are going to rise up and rebel because of these sanctions. And as a news reader, I'm a little skeptical of that. But how would I go about, if not Ukraine, the environment, other stories? Where would I find these stories?
Yeah, thank you, Stephen. One source, I won't toot the horn too long and loudly here, on the Project Censored webpage, on the homepage, we have a link towards the bottom to independent news sources.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not by no means an exhaustive listing of all the independent news sources. It's by no means a 100% 24/7 all the time endorsement of any of the or news outlets listed there. But those are sources that we've regularly found, the project and the campus affiliates have regularly found to be useful mm-hmm. In terms of tracking down stories or angles on stories that may not be well represented in the establishment press. So that's an online resource that's available. That independent news source list was originally designed for students and faculty mm-hmm. participating in the campus affiliates program, but we found it answered needs. It addressed needs that would come up whenever we would speak at public events, and so we decided to post that on the website as a public resource as well. I think in terms of Ukraine, I want to point out two recent articles that I think are important that I'm not seeing. That I think go against the grain of that go against the grain of a lot of what's appearing in the establishment press, the U.S. press, about Ukraine and what's happening there. The first is a piece by Bryce Green for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. The title of the piece, in some ways, says a lot. Calling Russia's attack, quote, unprovoked, lets U.S. off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fairly deep dive into the history of U.S.-Ukraine/Russia relations that basically shows that it's, although a lot of U.S. media coverage is intent on showing Putin as a kind of a crazy man bent on a megalomaniac vision of power, personal power, when you understand ways in which the U.S. and indirectly NATO, the U.S. indirectly and NATO directly may have provoked Putin and Russia, it's like flipping the lens when you're at the eye doctor, and
yes,
suddenly things look different. So that's an article I would recommend. The other one that I've been that I read with great interest, and the two of you are probably already aware of it, was that Bill McKibben, I believe maybe a week ago, had an article in The Guardian, an op-ed in The Guardian, about how weaning ourselves of our gas and oil dependencies, meaning ourselves, meaning not only Western Europe, but also the United States, would free us from what he calls the petrodictators, the most obvious of which right now is Putin. But we can also talk about Erdogan and, you know, Venezuela and Brazil, right? And McKibben makes a great case for the advantages, you know, of ridding ourselves of these dependencies, you know, not only in terms of saving the planet, but also in terms of kind of our international relations. I think it's very interesting that The Guardian published McKibben's article. I saw a similar article in The Washington Post, another op-ed about reducing our dependence on Russian oil and gas. But in The Washington Post's version of the editorial, the answer is to drill more and faster here, right? So that's a little different than McKibben saying we have to reduce our dependence on Russian oil and gas, right? And that to me kind of, again, I don't want to make it about The Guardian versus The Washington Post. Not that there's poor reporting at The Washington Post or always great reporting out of The Guardian, but the editorial decisions on how to frame that, I think, are telling, not just about the situation in Ukraine, but larger kind of political ideological perspectives.
Andy Lee Roth, we're out of town. This has been a wonderful discussion. We'll hope to get you back on Ecotopia again in the future. Andy is Associate Director of Project Censored. Go to the website. You can get many of the articles he referred to on the website or even online, but we also urge you to get the book. Project Censored also does a radio broadcast. There's a newsletter you can subscribe to. There's a lot of great stuff. We thank you so much for being on Ecotopia and for your great work with Project Censored.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Stephen. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your great work with Ecotopia, an exemplar of the kind of independent news reporting that we've been talking about this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Coming up in just a minute, it'll be Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. Her guest today will be Larry Jansen of Hearthstone Bakery, and he's going to talk about baking bread. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia.
We love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new day.
North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fiber.